Okay, I'm recording.
Okay, cool.
You have notes. Where do you want to begin? Because we'll run off the notes, I'm sure, but begin wherever you want.
Okay. First of all, can you hear me all right and stuff?
Yeah, you sound good.
Okay, yeah, cool. Sometimes my audio setup, the sample rate goes higher or lower than what it's supposed to be, and it sounds all weird. The notes that I made were just, I just went through my history with church and stuff. And then at the very end, I tried to compile it into questions and just topics. So I guess I can start with history and everything, because that's what I usually see people do. And then we can go into estuary and just discourse in general, because that's what I'm really kind of both worried about and interested in.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Does that sound good?
Yeah, go for it.
Okay, cool. So I started out growing up in a Baptist church, and I live up in the Pacific Northwest, and that's where I've always lived. You could probably see the Canada American flag over there. And I grew up in a Baptist church, and I was baptized at the age of 9. And
why did you give scare quotes around baptized at the age of 9? I mean, you were put in the water, I'm sure you went in.
Spiritually, I don't know if I was baptized.
Okay.
Yeah, so I'm not sure if I was taking it seriously.
Okay.
Or if it was just the thing of like, oh, I see all my friends getting baptized, and I go to Sunday school, and so I wanted to, too.
Okay.
And around that time, when I was about 9 or 10, I moved to Guam. And Guam is a little island in the Pacific.
Now, obviously, you didn't move there on your own. Parents in military, or?
Okay. My dad is an engineer, and he was working with the military.
Okay.
And we only stayed there for about 9 months because all the projects there got canceled because of the Japan earthquake. And then we went home to our same house, this house right here. And that shook up a lot of things for me. And around that time, I was entering into middle school. And that's where my skepticism really began. So it started kind of early for me. In middle school, I read 2001 A Space Odyssey. And that changed a lot of the preconceptions that I had, and opened up a lot of questions for me about evolution. And at the same time, I didn't have a lot of friends moving back. And so I ended up reading a lot and just spending time in church, reconnecting with friends that I'd fallen out of friendships with people and started new friendships. And I was kind of disturbed by popular Christianity, specifically with like homeschooling, cultural divides. Like, I didn't really know how to interact with people.
You were homeschooled?
I was not homeschooled.
Oh, okay.
So I was going to a public school, and I just didn't know how to interact with people being homeschooled. And that's when I first kind of saw dividing lines being drawn culturally between secular and church, because I went to the public school there, public school system, and it wasn't a great school system. And we'll get into that a little bit later. But at the same time, around eighth grade, I entered like a depressive state because I started listening to Dmitri Shostakovich on recommendation of my music teacher. And Dmitri Shostakovich was this composer in the Soviet Union. And that caused me to read a lot about communism and history of the 20th century and the 19th century. And I also started listening to Hardcore History and hearing specifically an episode about Thor's angels and how Jesus was depicted in early Christianity and pagan societies. I was like, okay, kind of getting into like the comparative religion and like the, all these things are similar. So maybe one just evolved from the other and Christianity is just like that. And so that was skepticism. Now moving into non-theism, I was kind of like, okay, God probably doesn't exist and we're evolved creatures, and started believing in materialism and naturalism.
Now, when you say not, do you mean, I mean, because there's a little difference between non-theism and atheism. Did you choose non-theism intentionally, or did you just not want to say atheism?
I don't know really what I believed in. Like, I don't know how to, it wasn't like a organized thought. And I, in my notes here, I said amoral non-therapeutic relativism is what I'd classify it as. And maybe like pantheism. I don't know, because I was definitely spiritual. I never stopped praying through all of this.
Interesting.
Yeah. And I rejected moral realism. So I didn't know whether morals were a thing. Basically came down to all I can trust is my own experience. And I don't really trust what churches can tell me. And it was really flimsy belief. I flip-flopped on things all the time because I'm a middle schooler. This is middle school. And a lot of this is post-hoc reasoning on my part. So when I say moral relativism, I wasn't thinking moral relativism.
Right.
And
well, you're a middle schooler.
I'm in middle school and I'm reading books like I have a list of books here that I were influential to me. I read The Stranger by Albert Camus.
You read that in middle school?
I read that in middle school. And what else did I read? Everybody's First Mistake. I read Ayn Rand, The Virtue of Selfishness.
In middle school?
In middle school and high school, like over the summer. Yeah. So
you decided to have a meaning. You decided to have your meaning crisis young.
Yep. Get it out of the way. And like some life-defining books for me at that time, I read a lot of sci-fi, so I was a heavy science fiction reader, and every sci-fi book is like materialism and naturalism light. And so the effect from that is that I was very depressed going in middle school and high school, and I played a lot of video games and listened to a lot of music. And those were my two forms of escapism. And I wasn't involved in any community. I didn't go to church. My parents didn't make me go to church, even though that they regularly went. They went every week and they were participating in everything. And around this time, transitioning from middle school into high school, I was noticed by my youth pastor because I could clap on 2 and 4 in songs. And he invited me to be in the youth band. And I was really craving human connection at that time. And so I went into being into the youth band and I just did the bare minimum. I showed up and then after the songs were done, I left. And I was very non-sociable and probably...
What did the youth band do?
Just played songs. Like
for the youth or for church?
Youth. For the youth.
Uh-huh. So you had sort of the separate little youth service over here. And so you played songs for the youth, which probably where was the church. The church was playing older Christian music. And so you had special songs for the youth, or was the church kind of,
we can get into the music in a little bit because we had an interesting setup where first service was hymns and second service was contemporary.
Okay.
Well, that's just another little cultural divide.
Yeah. See, the problem when you have a script is that I get nosy and I start asking questions that gets us off. So I'll try and shut up. You keep going. You're doing good.
Yeah. Yeah. Feel free to interrupt me. I'm a horrible public speaker. And I talked to Michael before. And...
You're not a horrible public speaker. You're doing just fine. Believe me, I've talked to far worse.
Okay, good. I'll keep doing what I'm doing then.
Okay.
I talked to Michael, who you talked with earlier before.
Oh yeah.
And he asked me like, what was your experience growing up? And I had basically nothing to tell him. So, I'm just making sure I'm hitting all the big points here.
Okay.
So in high school and kind of college, because halfway through high school, I started taking community college classes. I was getting very into studying engineering. My high school had an engineering department because they'd hire people outside of high school into like Navy shipyards and stuff like that. So if you can use CAD and you know how to run a CNC milling machine, they'd fund the program there and you could be hired into like a low level position at the shipyard. And that was like I only enjoyed two classes while I was in high school. It was, band and engineering, and I was a marching band nerd. And once I started studying engineering and science like at a higher level, I really enjoyed its explanatory power, and it was, I was really at odds with like going to church and being in the youth band and not really believing anything. And then also studying science and being like, well, this fully explains the universe. And I was, didn't have a lot of friends at this time. I had one friend who I, who had texted a lot and that I grew up with. And a big changing point for me was reading C.S. Lewis and Mere Christianity and The Abolition of Man and The Problem of Pain. And those books reconciled those two halves for me. And in addition with John Lennox, he has a lot of good books and debates and stuff that I watched. And I was really believing in Christ at that time, but I was definitely in my bubble. And I didn't want to be outside of my bubble and let other people in. And at that time, there's always been a lot of like, I wouldn't say like crime in my area, but like stuff happening in and out, and a classmate was murdered. And that made me really think about how I was treating other people. And if I'm professing to be a Christian, am I loving my neighbor as myself? And it was a guy I sat across from in high school. So,
wow.
Yeah.
Now, what year in high school did you start reading C.S. Lewis? And it sounds like there was a pretty defined, you know, another, I mean, one turn was space, you know, 2001 Space Odyssey, and then you enter into this depressive nihilistic phase, and now you're reading C.S. Lewis, and and now you're wanting to be a Christian. So you're moving through chapters fast here. I'm not talking about how you're relaying them, but in terms of your life, I mean, middle school, you have your meaning crisis. High school, you come into this C.S. Lewis apologetic Christianity.
I was really looking for answers. So I was like keeping my eye out and searching for things and wanting to know why things were the way they are and if things could be improved. A big question for me, and a big question for me now, now that I've discovered Calvinism, is there such a thing as hope? And that was a big question in my life then, and a big question in my life now, because the categories I was thinking in were like deterministic or free will. And if we're deterministic, what does hope look like in a deterministic framework versus a free will framework, where G.K. Chesterton, he says, like, even in the most dire of circumstances, hope has to increase. Like the level of hope that you have, even in the most dire circumstances, increases. But if you're in a deterministic framework, how does that work? So I was really looking for hope, I think, and I looked in a lot of the wrong places first, and then eventually came back around to where I started with my parents' church. So it's kind of like the G.K. Chesterton journey of where you start out in one place, you go searching throughout the entire world, and then you come back where you started, and then you realize all the answers are there. And after that event, after my classmate died, I was really looking for how I should treat other people. And at that time, I started like four of the closest friendships I think I'll ever have or have had. And that was my first experience of living in Christian community. And let me see here. I failed a lot living in Christian community. I wasn't living in the right mindset of serving others. And so a lot of the ways I approached living in community were, what are the things that will make me feel good? And how can I get that from other people? And so I had another kind of radical phase where I realized reading, I have all these stacks of books over here like you usually do. Read books like Future Grace and other John Piper books, Desiring God, and realizing just how big God is and how small I am, and appreciating that humble position and wanting wanting oh yeah, the Heidelberg Catechism too. That was a big thing for me, learning the going through the Heidelberg Catechism, and just that starting question: what's the chief end of man? To glorify God. That's Westminster. That's Westminster.
Yeah. What is your only comfort in life and in death? Is the first question and answer of the Heidelberg.
Okay.
That's okay.
Yeah. Sorry.
That's fine.
Realizing that the chief end of man is not in myself was a big.
Right.
I'll put it that way.
Right.
Was a big turning point for me, and I've been trying to live up to that ever since. And so that was a very abridged version of how I got to where I am today. I started out in my parents' church and was eventually very frustrated with the cultural divisions that were happening. Like, especially with the 2016 election, I was like, why is acceptance of Trump being such a big thing for me living in community with my church? And that's not to say that my church was full of bad people who are Trumpers and whatever. And I don't think people who like Trump are bad people or anything. It was just, I noticed other things being chucked into my belief in Christ and wanting to live in community and serve that I couldn't really reconcile or find a pattern for, like, why is this a Christian thing? What does this have to do with believing in Christ? And I eventually left that church mostly because of that reason. And I think that was kind of a mistake, and that I kind of learned that lesson in my second church, where I really learned to appreciate my first one. So, and in my second church, that was an interesting experience because I was hired as a worship leader. So at that point, I was playing on two worship teams. I was leading the youth team, and I was a guitarist for the upstairs worship, is what we call it, because our youth portable was a little portable, kind of off to the side. And I didn't know how to sing at that point, and I had been hired to do that at some capacity. So I took singing lessons throughout all of that, and you know, there were some rough points, but for the most part, I got it, I think, and it was very valuable for me to know what it was like to be in charge of people, and just how things, different little agendas start happening.
Were you in college at this point?
Yeah, so I'm taking. I still am in college, and I was in college at that point as well.
Okay.
I was and working at a grocery store.
Okay.
So I was taking electrical engineering classes.
Okay.
So yeah, that was another thing, is that I was taking like differential equations and multivariable calculus and all that stuff while this is going on. So high strain part of my life.
Yep.
And I was getting really caught up in it and learning how to be a good leader and learning how to serve people better when COVID happened. And now there is no church and everybody's watching online and stuff. So I've since left that job and just been focusing on school and like where I'm going and all of that. And in that, I've realized just how insular churches have become and just how kind of disconnected on a lot of levels that churches have become.
Yeah.
And I found you while going through YouTube, and I found you through Dave, the distributist.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And I thought, oh, this guy is interesting. And I saw your C.S. Lewis and Jordan Peterson video.
Yeah.
And I work a job that I'm in isolation and I work late into the night. So I'll download podcasts, like 8 hours of podcasts, and go through them. So
yeah,
I just found a lot of your talks to be really good.
Hey, you can fill up 8 hours. I got a lot of material out there.
Yeah. So I did that. I did 8 hours of PVK for 4 months for 5 days a week.
Oh so,
yeah. There's a lot going on there. And you opened up a lot of like, cool, I love your discussions with people like Vaush and Jonathan Peugeot, because you like disarm every single conversation I've ever seen you in. Like, there's always a point where it can go downhill and people start drawing lines and stuff, and you're like, you're just not affected by it. And that's awesome. Like, I wish I could get to that level one day. I have a rule right now where I don't talk politics with my friends because I'm too scared about
where it goes.
The division lines.
Yeah.
Your discussion of estuary, I was like so shook by it because I was like, is this what I've been looking for the whole time?
Hmm.
Where people get together inside of church, outside of church, talk together. Mm-hmm. And it's not a place where at the end of it, somebody's going to ask you, will you accept Jesus Christ as your savior? And will you take communion with us? And it's a disarming space where people can come together and talk and really have discourse and discussion, which people aren't doing right now. I mean, I live in very divided and kind of a grid-like structure where certain friends can talk about these subjects, other friends don't talk about these subjects. My male friends can talk about these things, and I can talk about these things with my female friends.
Wow.
And everything has become little boxes where you can move between the boxes, but the boxes aren't communicating with each other.
That's interesting.
So I think we're caught up to where,
that was quite something. You've done a lot of living in your short little life. That's at least short compared to my life, but
I'm 21, so I'm not that old.
Wow. Yeah. You've done a lot of, you've been through a lot of things. Mm-hmm. That's very interesting. You know, I was rather unprepared for what the unleashing of a little word, a little common English word, estuary, would provoke in the little following I have on YouTube, but that's been enlightening as well. I'm trying to not say interesting to everything because everything interests me. well, let me ask you some questions. Mm-hmm. So you're taking electrical engineering.
Mm-hmm.
Church is on hold. What kind of a church have you been going to? Has it been kind of a Reformed Baptist church, kind of a Piper-esque church?
Sort of. It's all over the place. Okay. They have a list of what they call anchoring beliefs, but they don't put themselves out there as a denomination, really. Like, they don't call themselves a Baptist church or anything, but a lot of it does follow along John Piper-esque lines.
Are they part of the Acts 29 network?
Not as far as I know.
Okay.
It's a project that grew up alongside a charity.
What's the name of the church?
It's the church. And if you don't mind,
not look it up, you don't want to.
Oh, no, it's just that I was a semi-public figure, and so my pastor was both the pastor of this and the leader of an organization, so maybe after this, I can get the recording and, like, edit out some information, but...
Okay.
Yeah, there's lots of churches out there, though.
Yeah, there are. I just noticed that. Mm-hmm. Well, and that gets into, I mean... You're going to have a hard time editing this. That gets into what's at the heart of estuary,
mm-hmm.
which is how can we integrate these different little boxes that you've noted?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, church... When we say church has become insular, what do we mean by that? I think we mean by it that there are broad other conversations going on outside the church in the world, and the church, for all of its world-changing aspirations, seems unable to speak a lot of these languages. And the mm-hmm. people who are speaking a lot of those other languages aren't understanding the church. And that's not necessarily a problem for them in their perspective, because mm-hmm. you know, the segmentation. So I was listening to Rebel Wisdom. I didn't listen to the whole video this morning. I just started listening to it, and then I had to do other things. But this Australian from Aboriginal background, it looked like, was, I guess he wrote a sand talk book. And he was talking about standpoint epistemology and some of these ideas. And, you know, I think the points he was making were appropriate in terms of, you know, we're part of what we're dealing with right now in the recession of mass media and the continued impact of the internet is we are recognizing all of these different standpoints, and the standpoint epistemologies of multiple people are inhibiting mass meaning making, which was something that was sort of afforded in a mass media era. And this obviously has broken down churches and their ability to understand one another. So, you know, the last iteration of church, a typical church website would have the picture of the church building, mm-hmm. your service times, some videos or audio recordings of sermons, and then a page of beliefs. Increasingly in the 80s and 90s, you know, they would tend to sort of push away the denominational ties because the local church wanted to have a degree of autonomy mm-hmm. in branding itself. And the denomination was sort of a large brand that would be problematic on one level or another. And a lot of churches went non-denominational, sort of cut the thread altogether and said, well, we'll make this up ourselves. And so then you sort of get this situation where you have multiple church plants going on. Each of these pastors is sort of starting a church plant with their own vision. But yet there are patterns and commonalities that are increasingly rippling through the pastor, the culture. And many of those patterns and commonalities have a great deal to do with celebrity pastors. So this is a John Piper church. This is a Tim Culture church. This is a Hillsong church. This is a John MacArthur church. Now, of course, you've got the Roman Catholic and Orthodox churches, and you've got other denominations. So, and so you have all of this segmenting of everything, mm-hmm. and then people see that out in the world and they begin to recognize, oh, that's what's happened in church. I wonder if that's true of me. I mean, earlier in your history, you talked about mm-hmm. your bubble. And right. the fact mm-hmm. about human beings are we all need bubbles. You can't live without a bubble. And mm-hmm. you describing, you know, your lack of community, I mean, it basically sounded like, you know, especially during the meaning crisis phase of your life, you're sort of adrift and you're, you know, reading these pretty heady books at quite a young age. And, you know, then you find yourself back in the church and you find yourself back with a tribe and you find yourself back again, being able to once again create community, because communities require these bubbles, because you've got to be on the right? same mm-hmm. page. But that selection means you're selecting this and you're not selecting that. And
exactly.
You have knowledge of these other communities, but you know, maybe if you've got enough time to pick up all these different languages of the other communities.
Right. Yeah. There's a big lexicon problem that's not just happening between churches, but between social justice and the legal lexicon and the, you know, cultural Gen Z, millennial, Gen X, boomer divide. They all have different lexicons. And it's like, is my... You know, when I say religion is my religion, the same as your religion, just kind of like that Slate Star Codex article about murderism. It's like things get very sticky and fall apart if people aren't on the same page. And I mean, the communities do need dividing aspects. Like you're not a community about anything unless you have defining quality. So you're not a Christian church unless you believe supposedly in Jesus Christ or the supremacy of Jesus Christ, unless you're Canadian universalist, whatever. Right. And that still blows my mind, by the way.
This gets into the estuary business because, mm-hmm. you know, part of the discussion in the Discord has been, well, is estuary church? And I always presented as something downstream from church, mm-hmm. In that I think you're right that churches have a degree of rigorous commonality that allow them to work as established communities, and you're going to have diversity outside of that by virtue of the fact that there's going to be different things coming at it, and also the fact that now in our post-Christian age, it's going to be very difficult for some people to sort of adopt a fideistic propositional, these are the things I believe, because churches have used those frameworks for a long time, and there's strong reasons that churches have used those frameworks. The utility of that framework is not going away. And you can see that because I listen very carefully to lots of other people that on one hand dump on that framework and then a moment later continue to tell you exactly what in fact they do believe. And it's like, well, you know, I could write those things down and you would say yes to them. And if I would differ from them, you might take on a rather pragmatic libertarianism, say, well, you do you and I do me, but this is the truth. And it's like, well, that's kind of, we're very hard pressed to get away from that. And because mm-hmm. it's just so useful in terms of understanding one another. But, you know, you got me talking and I'm talking too much, so I'll shut up.
Oh, it's okay. Yeah, this is great because, I mean, estuary, I think there something like it needs, or I don't want to say estuary. I want to put it into my own terms kind of to see if we're talking about the same thing.
Okay.
So I noticed that you use estuary in a very metaphorical way.
Yes.
If you were to put it in a non-metaphorical way, if you were to put it into a definition that you'd find in Webster's Dictionary, how would you phrase it? Because to me, what if I were to read estuary in the Oxford Christian Dictionary or whatever, and it would be a discussion place outside of the church, but still somehow connected to the church. Or it would be groups of like-minded people searching for answers together. Or it could be a Christian atheism meetup club or something of that effect. So it's kind of an amorphous term.
Well, the term came to me when I watched what was happening. Mm-hmm. So first we were acting things out. And so how can I describe what I see happening? I saw it happening in our local meetup. I saw it happening on my channel. I saw it happening on the Bridges of Meaning Discord. So then I'm trying to describe what's happening. And listening to the people in my local meetup, in many cases, the people who weren't going to church, and sometimes the people who don't identify as Christian, expressing the value that they saw in the relationship to this particular church and myself as a Christian pastor, I saw it better from their side. But I also saw it from churches in North America that are of evangelical persuasion more or less say that they have this mission to evangelize the world. Mm-hmm. Well, if you start looking at that mission and looking at what's going on in churches and you start thinking enough about that, you're going to see some real problems. Mm-hmm. And you're going to see a whole bunch of ways that over the last 50, 75 years, churches have been trying to get around these problems. And if you broaden the scope to include mainliners, to include Mormons, Jehovah's Witnesses, to right. mm-hmm. And then even to look at corporations in terms of what corporations have done, because corporations, interestingly enough, are also sort of church-like. I mean, Apple Corporation mm-hmm. in some ways has values that they wish to promote in the world beyond simply selling their hardware products. Mm-hmm. And that, watching the development of that, especially with the LGBT and woe, I mm-hmm. mean, it's been very interesting mm-hmm. watching stock selling corporations take on moral posture.
Yeah, sometimes at odds with their own shareholders.
Oh, that's
amazing. Yeah.
You know, all this dumping on capitalism, it's like Apple Corporation, a $2 trillion, you know, corporation is dumping on capitalism. What, they got $200 or $300 billion in the bank, but boy, we're there for the oppressed. And it's like, uh-huh. Yeah, well, why don't you cut the price of your computer stuff? You know,
right.
we're making sure we have healthy market shares, and you know, we'll make sure Foxconn puts up those nets to catch all the people who want to commit suicide. Oh no, even death can't get you out of this bad job. So you know, there's just so many ironies watching this go on, and so you watch the church and you say, yeah, the church. And of course, that's the context for my own career. So, and then I look at Estuary I look at what I've seen happening around me over the last couple of years, and I try to paint a picture of that. And then it's been interesting watching people, because of course I'm seeing stuff. Other people are seeing different things, and we're at least close enough that we sort of mm-hmm. know what we're talking about. But, and that's the whole point, that as I listen to them, I'm learning. And as they're listening to me, they probably wouldn't keep listening if they weren't learning. So then I say something like, well, I think every church should have an estuary. And what do I mean by that? I think the value of the estuary for the church is that the church needs to do a lot of learning. And when I say learning, I don't mean, you know, I've got lots of, not in this part of my study, but I've got lots of books that were written over the last 20, 30 years that would be church mm-hmm. mission type books. And most of them sort of say the same thing. Most of them get outdated pretty quickly. And most of them sort of silt up with jargon and need a good dredging. And so, you know, the metaphor I use, because I think a lot of people want to kind of distill it down into a bunch of if-then scientific type things. Mm-hmm. This is what we do. This is what we don't do. These are our value statements. Here's our mission statement.
Where's my flow chart?
And all of that has value. I'm not dumping on that mm-hmm. because those are tremendously helpful tools for communities to organize in order to accomplish tasks. Mm-hmm. I do see it as accomplishing tasks. I want the church to learn. I want those outside, because the other experience I had was people in church, either I think they know more than they're letting on in terms of, because most of them have plenty of friends who are outside the church, but mm-hmm. people outside the church really have no idea of what's going on inside the church. And
right. mm-hmm.
and that's a real problem for the church. And so one of the things that the church has to learn is someone who decides they're going to go to another culture and become a missionary has to learn the language of the other culture. And so that's mm-hmm. part of why it's the church's job. And to the degree that the churches can get this right, well, they'll probably have more fulfilling conversations. Now, there's a whole series of other issues on the church side that are also, and this is where the conversation in the on the Christian side of the line gets much more dicey. Because the church likes to imagine that these, and this gets so complex because you've got Orthodox who really don't change. You've got the Roman Catholics who are playing around with change. Mm-hmm. And you got the Protestants that are like, we're all about change.
But my hymnals aren't the color that I want. We're splitting off.
That's right. Yeah. But they're not really so much yeah. because there's stuff beneath the non-essentials mm-hmm. that they're saying are essential. That's sort of the framework that they use. But how mm-hmm. those things are connecting, not entirely clear, especially in a context of rapid social change. So the glory of the Protestant church has been being able in many cases to be sort of fast on their feet, but that's also been the misery, because then mm-hmm. the question is, well, what doesn't change? And so then the mm-hmm. easy Protestant answer is always the word of God doesn't change. Oh, okay. But then let's talk about what the epigenetic layer is above that.
Right.
That mm-hmm. finally expresses itself in Hillsong or John MacArthur or Mennonite chanting or, whatever, because right. that's the mm-hmm. thing about Protestants. It's like, whoosh, it's the supernova yeah. come to church. So, yeah.
Yeah. I'm noticing two trends, at least among young people. Like people my age, my friends who are Christian and not Christian, they either fall into the Christian atheist category, at least my friends who are like, they're into Jordan B. Peterson and they're like, all this tradition stuff, metaphysically not true, but there's lots of practical knowledge there. And I have some non-Christian friends who know Christianity better than most Christians.
Absolutely.
Right. Mm-hmm. And that's like a big trend right now, is that I have friends who know more than I do about the history of the Christian church, which is kind of a shame. Like, I think I should know that stuff. Yeah. And there are churches who want to hold fast to certain systems. Getting another book, one second. So I grew up with this guy, Systematic Theology. And there's no room for interpretation.
Raise it up a little bit more. Oh, Gruden. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. All right. You're looking for the author.
Yeah. I want to know who's systematic theology, because there's a lot of them out there.
Right. Or systematic reform theology or yes. Calvinist reform
right.
church
so,
theology.
So in the Christian reform yeah. church, it was Louis Burkhoff. Mm-hmm. And there was the big blue Louis Burkhoff systematic theology. And mm-hmm. then there was the compendium, which was smaller, and the manual. And so that in the middle of the 20th century, the Christian Reformed Church rolled that out. And mm-hmm. the fact that about the only people today writing systematic theology as such, I mean, you'll find some from, what's his head in Southern California, and Wayne Gruden. I mean, you'll find it sort of in the neo-Calvinists, Reformed mm-hmm. Baptist tribe now. And what's interesting to me about that is it's in some ways a hyper modernistic Calvinism,
mm-hmm.
which is, see, Calvin is a little bit earlier than that 17th century wave where modernity really kicks in. And so anyway, there's tons going on beneath the surface in these things.
Right? Mm-hmm.
But you can't deliver all of that nuance in a community packaged program to simply roll out. And so mm-hmm. John Piper, to his credit, and a lot of the neo-Calvinists, let's say the Gospel Coalition tribe, has really done a rather remarkable thing in what they've done. But there's a lot underneath there that if someone knows a fair amount about, the stuff at the top can get problematic.
Right. And so, I mean, you need malleability, basically. If you're going to hold strong and fast to this, and there's something in there about evolution and how you can't, sorry, I just clipped the mic, but how you can't interpret the Bible in evolutionary terms, like the creation story, it's like it's tempered glass. If one part of it breaks, it all shatters. And then you become more atomized. Okay, whereas we believe in systematic theology, but we're evolutionary systematic theologians, and we're going to believe that instead. And then another 1,000-page compendium comes out where your own theology is being practiced, and you can atomize and atomize and atomize until it gets down to the individual level. When really, I think the solution is having a little bit of malleability, maybe having a church doctrine or something like that, and saying, this is what we, when it comes down to the democracy of the church, this is where we're going to fall on our issues. And even in that, there can, like, churches change over time, so things can change. And in outside of that current, I see my friends who are Christian atheists, and they're like, we want a little bit of structure, right? We want a little bit of this church stuff, and we might go to church and have the community, but we're going to be Christian atheists. And then I see other people, myself included sometimes, where I'm like, I want ultra-orthodoxy. I want everything to be defined for me in these terms, and I want to be able to study it and go to a book and open up a book. Ironically, that isn't the Bible, and say, okay, this is what I believe. And I see, like, that's kind of where Jonathan Peugeot is interesting, where he's crossing into a whole bunch of different ponds, and he has his toes in different pools and stuff like that. But he's holding to this Orthodox Christianity that is so old and has so many traditions. And if you go to a church, everything has a different meaning, like the doorknobs that they use have symbolic meaning.
Right.
And like, that's a big disparity between people. And that's another solution where I see estuary coming in, where people can exchange different beliefs and ideas, and nobody has to hold fast necessarily to anything except for the conversation. But a worry that I have in that is that people will bind and blind inside of estuary and create their own enclaves and stuff like that. So you'll have in-groups and out-groups and culturally repugnant others and all that jazz of like, okay, maybe estuary one day will evolve into just a new church or into a secular meeting group. Because I mean, listening, I haven't listened to The Meaning Crisis with John Vervaeke a whole lot. I've listened to the first episode. I've listened to his interview with you a couple times. And the religion that isn't a religion is very appealing right now, because it gives you all the comfort without necessarily the commitment. And that's why I think you see things like Epicureanism, Stoicism, moral therapeutic deism, and cults of personality, political parties, superstition, witches. Witches are coming back, I guess. All these people will grab onto these things for the meaning part of it, but not for the commitment part. And they ultimately, I don't think, will get what they want. Because when the buck stops for me at Christianity, and that's my personal belief, and I'm not going to push that on my friends or anything, but I try to impress on them that they need to live in some sort of community. And if it's not based around serving one another in some capacity, that in-group and out-group dynamic is going to become very prevalent, where everybody's working to go to the inside and working as hard as they can to stay on the outside, like a group of penguins that are huddling to keep warm in the center. And that's very worrying to me, because that's every political movement right now. And that's every cult of personality. Like, I'll tell you a religion that isn't a religion, a UFO death cult. So it's like, or what the cult of rationality, whatever Robespierre did, those are all religions that aren't religions. They didn't do that well. Yeah. I'm sure John Vervaeke, I really like him. I think he's a kind guy. I think people are much more tribalistic than he is. And so that's the difficulty that he's going to run into. People aren't going to want to listen to psycho technologies when a cult of personality or something to that effect is offered to them.
Well, the time, you know, so, you know, I started this clips channel now. And so for me, that's sort of an way to organize some clips that I don't want to lose. Mm-hmm. And to highlight some videos that I think are important. I mean, Douthat, in that conversation with Steve Smith and Tara Isabella Burton, made the comment that Marianne Williamson, if she had risen to prominence in the 19th century, probably would have started a church. something like, mm-hmm. say, Mary Baker Eddy or some of these other burned over district movements that arose to prominence in the 19th century. So then the question is, well, why didn't she? Why didn't a church form behind her? You know, and listening to your story, part of my question is, mm-hmm. so you say of your friends, you know, you're not going to push Christianity on them. But my question underneath would be, what's affording the friendship? Because, okay, you know, yes. in sort of a Tom Holland way, your friends, whether they like it or not, have so much Christianity, Christian morals, and all that stuff built into their assumptions, they don't even know it. And on the Christian side of things, we have so much other secularity. I mean, if you and your friends have enough commonality in many, many, many dimensions, that if the friendship is something durable that lasts over a significant amount of time, now you haven't lived that long and you haven't had, you know, a bunch of other mixing things that come, you know, marriages and children and jobs and relocation. I mean, that's going to monkey with your friendship matrix as you go on. But the, you know, there's very basic questions about what allows people to understand each other, find their time together enjoyable. I mean, one of the things we have going on in our culture right now, which again is quite unprecedented, is that we have, if someone has a decent internet connection available to them, what they have at their fingertips at this point is truly shocking. I remember when VHS players became affordable enough that you could get one for $200 or $300. And then suddenly you had first you had the local video rentals, then you had Blockbusters, where you could go and rent, you know, you could rent a movie. In other words, you didn't have to wait until one of the three and then four main networks or a local channel would show a movie on TV or something would come to the theater. You could watch the movie you want, and you could watch it multiple times if you bought the video. I mean, this was not that long ago. And so mm-hmm. now we're in a situation where affluent, middle class Westerners have so much content available to them that obviously there's sufficient content that if you could satisfy yourself simply with viewing or reading or something like that, you could easily exhaust 80 years taking out the time you needed to sleep and eat. Totally. So, mm-hmm. so there's stuff going on underneath the surface here that the Christian label doesn't necessarily attend to.
Can you give an example?
Well, the fact that you, so you have friends that go to church, you have mm-hmm. friends that don't go to church. You have mm-hmm. these Christian atheists out here, and then you have the Christian Christians over here, and they can get together and have meaningful conversations. And in some ways, you know, in that meaningful place in the middle, the Christian thinks to themselves, I'm not having these conversations with Christians. And right, the atheist yeah. thinks to himself, I'm not having these conversations with atheists. What is this? What is this space we're creating? And what is beneath the surface that is common mm-hmm. to us that is affording this community? We have no idea. We're just experiencing it.
I have some sort of idea because my Christian friends, we've always been part of study groups together. So I think I'm a lifetime learner. Like, I like learning things, and that's part of what sets me apart from maybe some other people, is that will somebody sit down and read The Stranger in their lifetime? Probably not. Like, most people won't. And my Christian friends are the same way. They'll stick to what they know and what they what the questions that they're asking. So if they're Christians, they might be asking a whole array of questions with the rose tinted glasses on. And same thing with my atheistic or non-religious friends. And with my non-religious friends, part of the commonality that keeps us together is that we all have discussed meaning before. And so I'm not trying to be sneaky about it or anything, but I'll address what I think about meaning and they'll address what they think about meaning. And like, we just recently started reading books together as like a book club. And we're reading Notes from the Underground. I quoted Notes from the Underground in my letter to you. And the first book that I suggested was The Abolition of Man. And this book changed my life because it got me asking relevant questions. And so, you know, I wasn't subtle about it. I was like, I love C.S. Lewis. He's like part of what made me a Christian. I think we should read this book. And they're like, cool. Yeah, let's read it. So beyond that, what drew us together at first was engineering and science and growing up in school together. And all friendships start with certain commonalities that everybody can enjoy, hopefully. But it's where does it go after that? And that's something that I think, that specifically is something I think that has been lost to many Christians. To form community outside of church. And it's hard. I'm not saying it's easier that I have answers, and I'm kind of a schmuck too. I fail at serving my secular friends all the time. I get frustrated explaining things all the time, and I'm supposed to say truth and love. And it seems that evangelical culture in particular has the buck stops at church when it comes to spiritual discussions. And everybody's craving that spiritual discussion or the meaning crisis discussion and things of that nature. And I've made more deeper friendships outside of church talking about these things than I have really in church, which is mind-boggling to me.
Right.
You know? So maybe I'm unique in that.
And it's because you've got some of the order chaos dynamics going on. You know, you've got the two brain hemisphere stuff going on, and church is okay. You know, we've covered this before. There's a lot of mapped territory in church, and out there there's a lot of unmapped territory. And so you're drawn to that, and you know, to the degree that you have credibility with your friends who aren't going to church and are not Christian, for whom the church is unmapped territory. I mean, there's a middle space in between where you find each other. And, but you know, you're exactly right. And so you have all of this other, the church has been struggling with what to do with, to what degree is a frog Christian?
Well, it's part of God's creation, Paul.
Well, that's right. Yeah. So you've got Abram Kuyper, who, you know, there's not one square inch of the created order that that Jesus doesn't cry out, "This is mine." Boy, a phrase like that would scare the willies out of certain non-Christian people. It's, these Christians, they're claiming everything. Well, every totalizing schema claims everything. It's a definition of totalizing. The question is, what practices within the culture are the things that afford this? You know, in the Discord conversation after the homeless conversation last week, you know, I thought Joey made a really good point when he talked about, you know, part of what we're trying to spread is a culture, and cultures are very difficult things to exhaust with propositional mappings, because they're enormous. If we were to sit down and try to exhaust even the contents of this video right now, you know, how I move my head, the details of my headphones, the wrinkles in my shirt and how they move. I mean, there's so, this gets into the cognitive science stuff. I mean, there's so much built into our realities that we have this, we have these capacities around us that, that allow us to filter out, to select and filter. And we must do that. I mean, analogies with compression algorithms are helpful here, because the video that we are recording right here will get severely compressed down to, say, an MP4 container that is at least not too big, but not too small to get the right resolution. And I mean, we're always doing this. And so when you get together with your non-Christian friends, okay, what's going on there? And that's why everybody, well, okay, well, this is, we want to label estuary and what exactly it is. And it is. And then that's part of the reason I'm like, let's hold off on that labeling for a while. Let's just swim in it for a while. And at some point we'll have to put a sign up there in the mud. And the day will come and we'll all sort of know it when we need that sign. But probably not yet.
That's totally fine with me because I definitely have the urban blockhead complex where I just want to say a horse is just a means of transport, you know? Yeah. And I want to say, well, what is estuary? Is estuary just this thing?
Right.
So maybe something will emerge from that, and I'm comfortable with that. Like, I don't need people to conform with what I want, but
there does need to be a degree of agreement, which is where people get together. And that's, there's a lot of implicit agreement when people are getting get together, but then you ask them, well, why did you come today? Well, I thought it would feel meaningful to me. Okay, well, let's go a little deeper into that, and that gets interesting. It also gets complex quickly.
I like the compression metaphor because, you know, you're basically saying that no. It leads back to the your people have cartoon vision where they see the cartoon versions of things first, and it's almost anti-cartoon vision, but it's not lossless compression, you know?
Right.
MP3 files, I might get crucified for saying this, but they're lossless compression, you know?
They're if lossy. You listen,
yeah.
They so, are lossy.
They are?
Oh, okay. Yeah. FLAC is lossless, or at least more lossless, but...
But here's the debate is, can you hear the difference, you know?
Right. Exactly.
People get a high-definition MP3 file no matter what they... So you're not really losing a whole lot unless you're a certain type of person. I mean, my hearing isn't good enough for that. I really damaged my ears being on in a drum line. So like, I won't be able to tell the difference at all, but every conversation is lossless where you are putting things in little boxes for people to understand and you're conforming to different lexicons and stuff like that. And things are lost there, but the deeper the conversation can go, the more will be gained. Like if we can end this conversation now, you will have a cartoon vision of what I believe. If we continue it every week for a year, you'll have a much deeper understanding. Right. So I could see that as being a huge advantage in estuary conversations. And same thing with meeting with a group of friends and having a conversation about the book. The book may provide some cartoon vision for you guys to all gather around, no matter how esoteric it is. But I'm interested to see how relationships, peer-to-peer relationships, will work out on that level.
And the fact that we've all got so many there was one point in my life when I was trying to how many disconnected how many disconnected circles of relationships am I participating in? Now, of course, doing things on YouTube means a exponential explosion of those for me, which is in some ways unhealthy because, you know, say a book like The Abolition of Man, you and your friends read it. You and your friends read it in your early 20s. There's a degree of appropriation of C.S. Lewis and his ideas that you can do through that book, which is limited by the fact that you're all in your 20s. You read it again in your 40s, there'll be more. You read it five times instead of one time, you'll see more. And that's sometimes the degree to which you can tell the quality of some piece of literature or art is the degree to which you can keep going back to it and discover more. Now, is this an inkblot test? Is this a Rorschach test? To what degree are you bringing things to it or taking things from it? And, but again, reality is like this. And yet we have this, we have this innate salience mechanism that is sort of leading us towards things and leading us away from things. And to a degree, the Verveke stuff is about, there are honey traps that are, you know, squirrel, bang, sex, money. I mean, there's lots of stupid human tricks that you can, that you can trap humans with, like the monkey in the jar. And, but at the same time, those salience, and even when I call them mechanisms, I'm revealing the modernistic naturalism that's built into my culture because we say they're mechanistic, whereas a Greek would have called it a muse, where we're conjuring up a spirit, which is something that is resistant to deconstructing down into a whole bunch of little causal mechanisms. So I mean this stuff it gets hard to talk about, but increasingly as communities and cultures we've got better and better handles on it, which is part of the reason we're having a meaning crisis, but it's also affording a degree of power over each other, which is similarly dangerous.
Yeah, the better stuff somebody is made of, the better or worse they can go, you know? So I'm seeing, you know, as people get a grip on, and like a lexicon and all these words and ideas to get a grip on what meaning is. And I especially see it in meme culture. Like the amount of memes that are self-referential and talk about how they want to die and are, and oh, my life is so meaningless. I mean, that's the dominant trend right now. It's amazing. And that equally affords itself to cynicism and narcissism.
Which is a fascinating thing. Well, we where are we going? Do you have more questions, or shall we wrap up, or what would you like to do?
I'll see where my notes are right now. I think we touched on a lot of things, and I don't want to waste your time or anything. So
no, it's not a waste, but
I mean, I guess I'll be interested to see what comes of where boundaries are set for a lot of people. I like the cosmic image that Peugeot did and the connection that you made to the cosmic image, because there's a very clear wall of what's inside the church and outside the church, but who knows where things could go right now. So I mean, like, that's where I'm at right now, I guess that's what I'm trying to say.
And what are the walls of the church? I mean, those are interesting questions too. So we have this metaphorical layer that we're working on, but you know, it's interesting too in your story how, you know, your love of music sort of kept you with a tie to the church. Your relationship with your parents kept you with this tie to the church. And, you know, your journey's, Lord willing, just beginning. I mean, you get out of college, it's going to be job hunt, and it's going to be questions about romantic partners and,
right,
you know, mm-hmm, marriage partners. And I mean, life, these things in life keep throwing,
yeah,
new things at you. And who knows where, you know, politics and social arrangements go in this country. So it's, and you're living in one of the more volatile areas right now in terms of the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff going down up here.
There's a lot going down up there. And it's interesting, you know, why up there? And it'll be interesting to see. I was listening this morning a little bit to Heather and Brett, and they made the comment of, you know, this is the nicest time of year in Portland. They're a little cooler than Sacramento. This is a pretty impressive time of year. Mm-hmm. But once, you know, once it starts to rain up there, you get into your rainy season, and, you know, we'll see how much people want to be out there on the street. Those umbrellas will be up instead of forward. So anyway, it's interesting. It's interesting. So
I hope it was somewhat illuminating for you to, like,
no,
get something from like a younger audience member or something like that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And hearing your story, the fact that the books you were reading in junior high, that sort of blows me away. I mean, it speaks to your intelligence, but it also, there's a degree to which the education system has been pushing a bunch of things younger and younger. I mean, mm-hmm, I didn't start calculus until I went to college. You know, my mm-hmm kids were well into calculus at the high school level.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, the degree to which my kids were doing literary analysis in high school, I wasn't doing a literary analysis like that in high school. And so mm-hmm a lot of this stuff, usually for economic competitive reasons, gets pushed down further and further into the lower, into educational realms. But there are also mm-hmm developmental aspects going on. And at the same time, I mean, there's just, the world is just so big and human society is so complex that these issues, I, you know, if you're reading Camus as a middle schooler, I'm just thinking, how does that mix with your where you're at developmentally? Because there's mm-hmm a biological developmental. I mean, your brain plasticity, you know, you're not mm-hmm even, your brain still has quite a bit of plasticity. And
I think I got until 25.
You got until 25. Mm-hmm. So yeah. Work on some languages. You'll, mm-hmm, you know, travel overseas and mm-hmm pick up another language for, you know, right after you get out of college.
Right. Mm-hmm.
It'll be a beneficial thing for you. But
not to mention, I was reading Camus, I think eighth grade was around the time, and I picked this up while we were going through sections on the Holocaust. And that's what really drove me to, like, ask some of the questions posed in this book.
Yeah.
And schools have an interesting technique of throwing hard historical events at you with no support structure around it. So I think, I mean, I don't think there's anything unique about me, to be honest. I think a lot of people ask the same questions at the same time with very much less people feeding into their lives. I was very fortunate to have a church that loved me and would talk to me and support me through this, even though I wasn't really going to church or believe in any of that stuff. So, I mean,
And yet parents who, you know,
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are, I mean, just the fact you can live in the same house as your parents, you might not appreciate all that goes into that because, mm-hmm, you know, teenage homelessness, people who have ruptured relationship with their parents,
mm-hmm,
there's a lot going on. So,
mm-hmm, yeah.
Well, I will send you this video and you can edit it however you want and send it back to me and and then we'll decide what we want to do. All right?
All right. Sounds good.
Great.
All right.
Thank you,
Paul.
Take care.
Have a good day.
Bye-bye.